We welcome everyone listening to our first podcast ever. For us, that is Siri and Milena making a podcast, but it's also the first podcast about the Evosound Network. For this, we're talking to Detlef Arendt, who is one of the principal investigators of the network and who is a researcher at the EMBL, the European Molecular Biology Laboratory in Heidelberg. We will learn more about the evolution of cell types and the exciting research the EvoCell is intending to do and already doing. I am Siri and I'm one of the EvoCell PhD students. I'm researching on how to communicate the EvoCell research through an online exhibition.
And I'm Milena, I'm also a PhD student and I am doing part of the network's research. And we are here with Detlef, who is the coordinator of the network and therefore the best person to ask about what the idea of the network was and what we will accomplish doing our research. And also all the very exciting developments in the field of evolution and development.
Thank you, Detlef, for joining us. Could you tell us what your role in the network is?
I'm here in my function as coordinator of this EvoCell network. That was actually a very nice joint effort of many PIs, several PIs who know each other for quite some time and realize that there is an exciting new research direction that we would like to follow together and also shape together, because it's really very novel and there is a lot of pioneer work to do, which is always, such adventures are always fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we just finished our first graduate school, which was something like a gathering of the students who are in the network and of the PIs and of a few more persons and visitors who just met and told each other for two days what they are doing and how exciting it is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the network is about cell type evolution, and you obviously had started studying this years ago, cell type evolution. How did you get this idea? Why we should look into more into this direction and from a cell type perspective?
Yeah, primarily the emphasis is on evolution, also on cells, of course. But evolution is what I think interests all of us, and especially everybody here is in the network is, I think, excited by how animals evolve and what happened in animal evolution. And I think my interest, as much as the one of many others, is how can you, for example, understand what we look like as humans in comparison to a fly or in comparison to a worm. Yeah, many of us work on very sort of weird creatures. And what we would like to understand is how all of these different bodies that exist, so if you look around in the diversity of life, you see many animals that with the weirdest body shapes. And how did all of this evolve? How did all of this come together? And this is something that, of course, has always occupied mankind. Yeah, how one can figure out how animals evolved. But I think we are now in a phase where we might actually come to some concrete answers on how we can understand what happened in evolution from the very first metazoans, so the very first maybe little balls of cells which came together and formed the first multicellular animal, to something as complex as an octopus, for example. Yeah, and of course there are uninterrupted lines of generations of animals which just transformed minutely from generation to generation, but there has been a transformation of shapes, of functions, in all of these evolutionary lineages. And what exactly our ancestors looked like 600 million years ago, yeah, they existed. We know that, but we are only beginning to have a first idea of how these evolutionary lineages, what they looked like, how this worked.
So in the beginning, all life was unicellular, Only after millions, even billions of years, multicellular organisms, so organisms that are made up of more than one cell, originated. Multicellular organisms, including us, take only a small part of the biodiversity up. Yet they show such a high diversity in forms. And of course, they are the ones we mostly know of, as they are the ones that are visible by the naked eye, compared to unicellular life, such as bacteria. So it seems that the origin of multicellular life was a significant event in evolution. What do you think, Della? What is the reason behind it? What was it meant to happen?
Yes, of course. As always, we can only speculate, but it is true. There was an event probably where cells divided and then in a way stayed together and formed something like a small colony of cells that were then only semi-autonomous. And then a few very important things happened that I think made an advantage and that then led to a situation that this colony existence was no longer given up, because many unicellular eukaryotes can do that anyway. So they are actually also existing as small colonies, and they are forming something like little beings that are several cells together. But what happened in animals at the very beginning must have been something that some kind of division of labor occurred. So there was probably, these early cells were multifunctional, this is very clear. They had to do everything that a cell can do, has to do to survive. Yeah, they were sensing the environment, they were able to move, so they had probably a cilium, and they could contract, so they could change their shape, and they had whatever cellular functions you can imagine they had on board, yeah, because they had to, they were the only cell around. And then it was probably advantageous for them to somehow divide this labor or these functions into several different what we call types. Yeah? Mm-hmm. That it was advantageous that one cell from now on was specializing on sensation, for example, sensation of light or of some chemicals in the environment. Other cells maybe were specializing on storage of something or on feeding, first of all. Yeah, and yet other cells on moving around. Mm-hmm. And all of these functions were possible in the unicellular stage before, but I think it's easy to imagine that for the specializing cells, for these cells with division of labor, it was easier to specialize. So they could then really focus on one function. And I think that is a principle in evolution, division of labor and subsequent specialization that we encounter very often. Mm-hmm. And once you have that, and you have your then highly, highly specialized subfunctions in these cells, mm-hmm. that is something that is apparently quite efficient and survives better, and once it started, it then continued.
Yeah. So when I was in university and learning about evolution, especially these early stages, I think it was much more focused on a view from a gene perspective, and I think that is the traditional view of evolution, that what evolves is our genes, and that is where all the major events happen. How is it different to look at it from a cell type perspective, and what what different and new knowledge does that give us?
Yeah, well, that is as much as you sitting here in front of you. You are, of course, what you are physically and in terms of matter and what is essentially there, and not in terms of your DNA. Of course, the DNA has produced you, the information has been read and somehow transcribed and expressed, and the organism is the result of that. But what matters is the actual being. And I think this is the way, I would say this is the same with evolutionary theory, yeah, or evolution. Evolution, of course, is about the organisms that transform in time and space and get different and diversify and have a certain look and have a certain function and are amazing. Yeah. Whereas what is behind that is, of course, that there's also a change in the information, the genetic information that at the end is used or to build them, to reconstruct them every generation. Yeah, this is of course important, but this is in a way just the manual. Yeah,
Yeah, so we are looking at it in context, and when we look at cells, we can also take environment into account and all the interactions that happen and that make it so
exactly.
complex.
Yes, we are interested in how these organisms interact with their environment. Yeah, what made them change in history? What makes them change now? Yeah, mm-hmm. what is how all the organisms interact with each other, the individuals and within one population, and within one species, but also between species and everything, with their habitat. And all of this is playing together, yeah, and changing. And evolution is in a way trying to understand how this has always happened and then shape the organisms that live today. And of course, one way to understand that is look into the genetic information that they are carrying around. Yeah, and also compare that and see how sort of the instruction manual changed. But I find the actual thing is much more exciting and yeah than just being occupied with the changes in the information.
So to give an example on that, do you have like a favorite cell type or a cell type that has the most exciting evolutionary path?
I would name two, if I may. I've always been excited by photoreceptors, so those are the cells sending light, mm-hmm. and that is in a way a story about one molecule, which is the opsin, which used to be probably before it became an opsin. Of course, there was already a molecule around it. It was already doing something, and it was a receptor of a chemical.
Yeah, could you tell us what a receptor is, maybe?
Or a receptor is, well, a cell is full of molecules mm-hmm. that is able to bind whatever other molecule is around in the environment. Yeah, mm-hmm. And then this is like a lock key mechanism mm-hmm. that it's very specific, and they notice that this quality of molecules is around in the environment. They receive it. This is why it's called a receptor, and then they transmit the information that this is around mm-hmm. to the cell. So the cell has these sensors. Mm-hmm. They sense something. So the opsin is a light sensor. It is a molecule that is able to sense light. But there are other molecules that are specifically receiving the information that a certain chemical is around, and this is because they are shaped in a way that only that chemical can bind and then activate them. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And this light sensor that evolved was especially intriguing because it was one mutation that made a conventional sensor of something. It was a chemical called retinal that was of course important in the environment, but just one among many others. In a way, by chance, transformed this into a highly light sensitive molecule. That from now on the cell was able to perceive the amount of light in the environment of a specific wavelength, because only light of a specific wavelength was able to activate this sensor. Yeah, mm-hmm. And this was a huge advantage. So once this receptor was in place, mm-hmm. it was able to transform these organisms, because they from then onwards, it was not yet there, but from then onwards, sort of the ground. Was laid. The foundation was laid to evolve eyes, this happened then probably shortly afterwards that these sensors, light sensors, were used in the first eyes. They were put together with some shading pigment cells, and this was certainly a very big step in animal evolution. But the second cell type that is of course intriguing and that we are also very interested in. I think many people in the network are neurons, the cells of the nervous system. Those cells that in a way form a small computer and that they digitalize information. Yeah, they either fire or they don't fire, so it is a 0-1 kind of information transfer, just like as in a computer. Mm-hmm. And these cells are of course just little miracles out in the real world, how they came into existence. Is something that is fascinating us and many others, as I said. And this is something where also our network might give some interesting answers.
Yeah, what answers or what do we know so far from it about its evolution and origin? What is your theory on how and why they evolved and when?
Yes, I think this is very easy to answer, because of course it's about communicating. Mm-hmm. As much as communication is important between people, it's also important between cells and our nice and pet cell types. So they have to know what the other cells are doing, and they have to know about the environment. Mm-hmm. And so we have just talked about sensors. Of course, it's important that not only the sensor cell, but or the receptor cell, but also all the cells in the body somehow know that the environment has changed or that there is a new situation, whatever. And so it is very clear that cells within one animal body mm-hmm. have to communicate from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. Communication was evolved. And we know that many of the molecules that are important for the nervous system existed before the actual nervous system was in place. So, and these are communication molecules, exactly these receptor molecules and also sender molecules mm-hmm. that cells have also today in the nervous system. And the nervous system then was somehow about making this information more efficient by far. So somehow there was a quantum leap in bringing this information transfer communication up to speed. And this relates to the invention of something that we call the synapse, which is a small point of contact between neurons, yeah, where they in a very efficient manner and very fast transmit information. And so this upgrade of previously existing communication to this now nervous system communication, this is, I think, what we have to understand, how this was possible.
Mm-hmm. So what I've been wondering is, if and how can neural cells evolve by themselves? So to make this more clear, during our life we have mutations or changes in our DNA, and sometimes these changes are not repaired by the cell, and then dividing the cell can pass on the changes in the DNA. So we can have changes in our cell types during the course of our life. And I've been wondering if these changes, for example, in neural cells, can these changes be passed on to the next generation?
Well, if we have a genetic change, a somatic change actually in one of our neurons, and even if it is very beneficial, we might not be able to transmit it to the next generation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because at the end, the only thing we can transmit to the next generation are our germ cells. So yeah. Somehow we have to have a change in the genetic information that is encoded in our germ cells to pass it on. So if we have a change there, and it's somehow manifest in the neuron, so that, for example, our descendants then have something like a molecular machine in the neuron that is now slightly different, and if by chance this is different in terms of better and not worse, mm-hmm. yeah, then this is at least how evolutionary biologists thinks it works. Then there would be a higher chance of passing this on into the next generation, which is of course highly complicated.
What I think is important for people to understand in general is how does a certain mutation only contribute to a certain cell type? How is it regulated that a neuron mm-hmm. is a neuron, and what makes it a neuron, and how the changes in DNA happen in this specific way? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that is maybe something that we can explain. Why are not, even though all the cells have the same DNA, why they don't look the same, and why they can change as independent modules throughout evolution. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's important to understand exactly, because initially when in unicellular organisms, all information of the cell would, of course, or all genetic information would be accessible to this one cell. Yeah, might be that there could have been different stages in its life cycle, that maybe some genetic information was used only at certain times. Yeah, but in principle, the cell was able to access all information. And now we talked about this division of labor, that some cells really specialized on something, which on the other hand meant they were no longer doing the other thing. And it in the beginning this might have been conditional, so that this was maybe only temporarily and could be reversed. But what happened then is that with time, with evolution, it was advantageous to really close off some sections of the genomes for some cells. I think this is the best way to put it. So even though they have everything in the genome, during the development of these organisms, when the cells differentiated or reached their final state, yeah, their functional state, some of the information that was no longer, it was not needed in these cells, was just no longer accessible. So the genome that was partitioned, was subdivided into different parts, in that much of the genome was accessible for everybody in the body, so for all cells, but tiny sections were accessible only for these highly specialized cells that needed it. Yeah, this is something like a genetic program. It's actually, it belongs to what we call genetic regulation, gene regulatory networks, that this is organized during the development of the animals. But the end state is that these cell types have a little bit of the genome on their own. So they have, for example, they are able to access the information to build the light, the opsin, you know, this light sensor, for example. And this might be very unique to these cells, whereas other cells don't do it. And which means they even don't have access to this information. And when then evolution hits a part of the genetic information that is only used by some cells, then these cells will change only, and the other cells are not affected. Yeah, whereas when evolution hits something of these general usage genes, of course the whole body is affected. Yeah, but what is important, and this is what we are studying in the network, is how is it possible that some cells just change on their own without affecting any other cells? Yeah, and we think that this is due to this sort of subdivision of the genome in specific functional parts that and then only some cells can use. This is a new concept in a way, and we are eager to understand how this has occurred in evolution.
And traditionally, the way that we would look at these specific parts of the genome that are accessible to each cell type would be using different fluorescent markers to visualize cells that are using a specific gene at one point. But now we have a much more powerful technology to see what exactly each cell is doing, and not only with one marker, but to see all of the parts of the genome that are accessible to it, and all of the genes that it is at the moment using, and all of the genes that are making it the cell type that it is. And this is what unites our network, this powerful new technology called single-cell RNA sequencing that we will all be utilizing in our projects. So it is a complex technology that is difficult to explain, I think. Could you give it a go?
Yes, in a way it's very easy. First of all, technology is often driving science, actually, because all of a sudden something is possible that was not possible before, and then people have new ideas. They say, okay, now we can do this, and now we will do it. And what is possible now, which is really astonishing.
Can I quickly ask you, did you have this idea before the technology came out?
Well, we were always thinking, talking.
I wish this could be possible, and then suddenly it came up, or...
I think we always wished that we could get away from looking at genes of interest, because we knew they were somehow important, and then had a very tedious way of cloning them and making their expression visible in the animals. And there was always the sort of fear that we might have overlooked the even more important genes, yeah, by our biased view. And there was always the attempt to be, say, less biased in the approach, and at the end more complete in the approach. And I think we dreamt of knowing everything that a cell would express. Yeah. But then when the technique came, I think it was because we were so primed and so much waiting for maybe also technical advance in our field that we realized very fast that this would be now a new opportunity. And the technique in itself is in a way very easy to explain, especially with our small marine invertebrates that we are working with. So we are all working on marine animals, which are mostly very small, the ones we have chosen. They consist still of thousands of cells, or 10,000s or 100,000s of cells, but this is actually much less than, for example, our body is composed of, which is billions. And what a mouse is composed of, so which is still counting probably in billions. And what is possible now is simply we pick our animal of choice, which might be a small worm, or a small jellyfish, a small polyp, and throw them into a cocktail of digestive enzymes to the effect that they totally dissolve, and all the cells are now floating around and forming a big soup. So just imagine you dissociate an organism completely, and what you have left is a big soup of its constituent cells. That once you have done that, what is possible now is that you can pick all of these cells, or many of these cells, and individually, and sequence all the transcripts that are in a single cell. This was not possible before.
Quickly to clarify, when you say sequence the transcript, so you mm-hmm. could you clarify?
Yes,
that?
Every cell, as already explained before, reads out a certain part of the genome all the time. So what is characteristic for a cell is that it's, of course, it needs its instructions. So it uses the genetic information and reads it off. Yeah, we call that transcription, and produces little transcripts. Yeah. That are then again we say even translated into the sequence of a protein, mm-hmm. and so the information is translated into these the proteins, and they then perform a specific function, is of course especially then the function that is needed in the cell, mm-hmm. and knowing what is actually transcribed in a cell of the genetic information gives you a very good insight into what the function of this cell is. So because a photosensor, a light sensor, will, for example, read off the information for the opsin, how to build an opsin of the genome, and many other proteins that are needed for light perception, for example. And so you get a lot of information about the specific functions and also the specific sort of shape of a cell, yeah, the way it looks like. If you look at the genes that are transcribed and translated into proteins, and then knowing the cocktail of proteins that is typical for that cell. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden we were able to take all cells of the body and look and then know all the transcripts for each specific cell by sequencing them. Sequencing simply means that we are able to read this information, yeah, with a specific sequencing techniques, this is how we call it, and know at the end the order of bases or then amino acids that are characteristic for a specific protein.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all of it, cool. this is single cell sequencing, yeah.
So you mentioned before that we have specific animals we study, specific models, and everyone in this network has studies other model organisms. Can you tell us more about why we have very specific animals we, for example, use,
mm-hmm.
And what is the advantage?
Yeah, we pick them very well, and always with a reason. If you think about the evolution of animals, if you think about us and then need a good guess what would be the animal that is least related to us, for example, this is an important question because this is sort of our oldest cousin.
Mm-hmm.
Then one possible answer to this is sponges. This is one of the model organisms in the network that we have chosen. Sponges, I think, are a good example because they have few cell types. They have the specialization of cells is not that sophisticated, not that advanced. and that they have something like maybe 1 or 2 dozen of cell types. I think we said 17 is probably a good estimate for the animal we are working with. Which means not only have they branched off very, very early in animal evolution from the rest of the other animals and from us, from our lineage, but they also stayed with relatively few cell types. They don't have a nervous system, they don't have muscles, and this is one of the organisms we have picked to dissociate them completely, to dissolve them into their individual cells and then sequence them.
How old are they, or since when do they exist on Earth? What is your guess, or what do we think?
We like to think that this is about 600 million years ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the exact number is hard to give. Could be, some people would say earlier, some would even say later. But that's about the range.
And so what can we learn from the cell types of sponges in regards to ourselves? And are there some cell types that are similar to our cell types?
Yes, first of all, we knew nothing about sponge cell types, or not much about the molecules that they would use and the specific functions they had, realizing after we sequenced these cells how the functions were distributed. So this is very exciting for example, for people who have always been interested in sponges. There will be a lot of new information what the sponges can do, because we now understand much better what their cells can do. And in principle, the division of labor that we see in sponges is already reminiscent of what we even find in our body. So we uncovered that some cells are specialized on contraction more than others, which we also have in our body because we have muscle cells. Yeah, but of course our muscle cells are highly specialized in comparison to these contractile cells in the sponge, which have the contractile molecules but otherwise still look like normal cells, so they're not specialized to the same degree. And we also realize that there are some cells in the sponge that are more sensory, so they are able to sense the environment, just as it is in our body. It's just again that in our body, cells that are maybe even related to these ancient sponge cells are much more specialized than the cells in the sponge. In the sponge it was not so obvious, but by now sequencing these cells we saw that they are specialized on sensing the environment or other cells in the body. There are these, then we found some cells that are specializing on communication, obviously, because they are packed with so-called ligands, so the signals, and also the receptors, as already explained. Mm-hmm. And so we found something like a first communication network in these sponges that might be related to what later became the nervous system. This is of course something we would like to explore further. But at first of all, we can say yes, also these cells specialized on communication were already there. And then there are some other cells which we didn't expect at all. There is a cell which is specialized and really highly specialized on doing the metabolism in the cell. Mm-hmm. It's conducting what these processes that are producing energy in the cell, like glycolysis, so the resolving sugar into energy. And in sponges, this is apparently very much happening in one cell type, which was not known. Mm-hmm. And this is new insight that I think excites us as much as sponge biologists.
Yeah, puts everything in a whole new perspective.
Then most of the animals that we work with do have neurons, and some of us are specifically interested in the nervous system, and the nervous system is especially maybe rich in cell types. And I think most people view it as a special part of the organism in general, and in a maybe abstract way. Do you think there's something that we can learn specifically about the nervous system evolution using this kind of technology? Like, there are parts of the brain evolution that have been inaccessible to us using more traditional neuroscience methods. What does single cell sequencing technology have to offer there specifically?
Yes, I think we can learn something about the nervous system, and especially we can learn where it comes from and how it came about. And for this, maybe I should explain one insight that we get from working on so many different organisms is that we can compare the cells, the cell types between organisms. And it turns out that comparing cells at the molecular level, so by the genes that they express and their specific molecular identity, we have uncovered a very efficient means of telling which cells in the body of this species are related to other cells in the body of that other species. So we can at the end become as far as saying there are cells in the human body that relate to this specific cell type in the sponge, because there are similar molecules involved that we didn't know before. To put it very, very brief. And this now enables us to ask the question that we could never ask before. If we take a neuron of, even a neuron in our body, and look at the genes expressed, is there a cell in a sponge then even, that is somehow related to the cell? And what does it look like? And what does it do? And what can we learn from this about the evolution of nervous systems? So concretely, we can, for example, ask, what are the cells in the sponge that have the molecules that later on we will find back in the nervous system, in the cells constituting the nervous system? Mm-hmm. And this is the fascinating new possibility, because about the origins of the nervous system, we could so far only speculate. Now we have, I think, much more concrete, hypotheses on how the nervous system came into place just by comparing these cells. We are not there yet, so it's just starting. But from the little data that we have by looking into the species that we single cell sequenced already, there are themes emerging. And our big excitement about this whole field is that questions such as origin of the nervous system, origin of photoreceptor cells, of muscles in the body, and of many other things that make the animal body can now be solved.
Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of different organisms, as we said, in the network, and the aim is to compare these organisms in the end. And what are what you see for the future of the network, and what your hopes, what kind of outcome of our projects we may get by comparing all these animals. Obviously already said it, but what you see specifically in the network's future now?
Well, our humble ambition is we will get a completely new look on animal evolution, especially on how body plants came into place. So what is the chain of ancestors that has shaped certain animal lineages? How, for example, did the body plan of mollusks evolve? So how can we understand what they look like in comparison to their ancestors? We can even say how did the ancestry of vertebrates proceed? What happened in the very early lineages that then gave rise to vertebrates? And so these are fundamental questions for understanding animal evolution, and it's maybe even surprising to hear that this is not solved yet. We have not the slightest idea much of a controversy up to now what, for example, the last common ancestor of a fly and a human looked like. We know it existed, there has been centuries of debate about this, and it's not clear yet. And we think our network, by looking into the cells and reconstructing the cell types that were likely present in these ancestors, we will understand much more what it looked like and what it was able to do and what it was not able to do yet than before.
Mm-hmm. So we are at the moment, we are at the Stazione Zoologica Anton Dorn in Napoli, and you were giving earlier a talk about that Anton Dorn, he was a big inspiration for you. Could you tell us more about that?
Well, yes, because he had the very same interest.
Yeah.
I think many in our network are interested in exactly these questions that I just outlined. The concrete question, what happened in animal evolution? What did these animals look like and how are they related? And Anton Dorn had this ingenious idea that vertebrates during the evolution turned upside down. He came to this idea by realizing that there are a lot of similarities in the anatomically at that time between the nervous system, the neural tube of the vertebrates, and the nervous system, the central nervous systems of invertebrates. And what he realized, at this prompted him to propose that during their evolution they had simply turned upside down. Because at the end, what is your belly and what is your back is simply determined by your position. And this simple this simple process might have shaped vertebrates, and then from then onwards they had the nervous system on their back. And he was the founder of the Stazione Zoologica in Naples. This is where I think this whole complex of ideas developed. And so this is why it's nice to have the first graduate school of our meeting here in Anton Dorn's sort of old home, because I think we will also contribute something to the very origin of vertebrates, and maybe find even more or new perspectives on how vertebrates came about.
Yeah, there is a bust of Darwin in one of the conference rooms. It's all very inspiring for evolutionary research. Mm-hmm. As I said, I am doing the single cell research in the network, but Siri has a sort of special role, and her project is different, where she's doing science outreach and communication, and the science of outreach and communication. Detlef, can you help us in the outreach? Do you have any messages for that you want to transmit to whoever might be listening to this, and for us in talking to people about what we do? As I said, for me it is sometimes quite difficult to explain the technology and what the point of it all is and why I don't work in cancer.
Yes. But I think we have a very easy mission. So first of all, I think you need to have a mission. You need to know, okay, I'm doing this because I find this and that totally exciting. And I think many of us share the vision of understanding animal evolution, which is an evolution in general. And this is so fascinating that I think it doesn't require much. You can talk to everybody, and they will somehow understand that it is a valid question to ask yourself. Okay, what if I see this amoeba there? What does it have to do with me? And why are we different? And where do we come from? So at the end, the old question: where do we come from? And mm-hmm. even in, from a religious perspective, in the Bible you find long lists of descendants, of hundreds of names who gave rise to whom. So there was an effort, but it ends at a certain point because they couldn't track it any further. So we can go much further down and now from this scientific perspective solve this question of, for example, where we came from in the history of life on Earth.
Yeah, I find this super exciting, as I'm not doing research on cell types per se, but I'm looking into how to communicate, maybe especially as science. But once I'm surrounded by all you guys who do this very specialized science, but so fundamental, and everyone is so excited, everyone seems to have this curiosity of a child, and this is what I see a lot of researchers. It keeps you going, and I would like to see this also in the outreach, or in try to spread the excitement.
I think it's easy to be excited and passionate about evolution, and everyone who is even a little bit interested in science is, but the technology that we use is also amazing, and the approach to research that we have is also amazing, and I think that is somewhat more difficult to communicate, and I would really want to be able to make my friends and family excited about single cell sequencing, and I don't know if that is too hard of a task to attempt.
Well, if you imagine I mean, just for people to understand that they're actually composed of cells, yeah, that their body, which some people have some relationship to, others have less, yeah, so we have a kind of a strange view on our own body in a way, and starting to think that this all these different tissues that we have are composed of different cells, and what they look like, and what our mucus producing cells look like, or our kidney cells, or our brain cells, is something that is fascinating, I think. It's not our everyday business, but if you start thinking what you have in your body, and that this is an endless number, and that they look all different, and then starting to understand how these differences come about, or also understanding that actually we don't know yet. Yeah, so that without these techniques, it's only now that people are starting to think about a human cell atlas, which means nothing else that we get something like a first inventory of the cells we have in our body. How is this possible? We are doing science for centuries, and we don't know up to now what is actually happening in our body. Yeah, the human cell atlas is happening now, and it's only possible because we have the single cell sequencing technique now. We can track it now, but this is interesting for humans, I find. I find that amazing that we can get the first view on what is in us, essentially. Yeah, this is something I think we can communicate to lay audience, people on the street, your grandmother as you train today.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember when we started the network and you gave a talk, and I think you finished it with saying that we are, with the technology and with the network, that we are sort of entering a new era of Viva Diva, and everyone was really excited about that. So for the, yeah, I think for anyone who's interested in biology, that is an exciting takeaway, that we are in fact progressing a lot technologically, and when it comes to the idea that we are developing. And yeah,
Yes, I would of course subscribe to that. I am convinced. Yes, I said it.
Yeah.
And I said it for a reason.
Yeah.
Yes, I think it's not exaggerated. We do have a new opportunity in evolutionary research. It's no longer evolution and development, but it is evolution and cells. Yes, it's also a new discipline. It even doesn't have a real name so far. You can, EvoCell is the name of our network, and maybe that's it. Yeah, it is novel. It is a new perspective on animal life. We will clearly be able to solve questions that we couldn't solve before, where we were kind of stuck. It's the same interest that we share with scientists from 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. We know that. And they would love to be in the position we are in now, that we can have a closer look and maybe solve some of these issues that they have always been thinking about. And that is exciting. I think we have a unique chance, and that's not happening too often, I think, that you can start as a graduate student and say, okay, I was there when the new cell of evil, the new field of evil cell emerged.
Yeah, we are excited to be a part of it.
Yeah, super excited. Thank you so much for taking your time. It was very interesting, and I hope the listeners enjoyed it as well. And we'll hopefully produce some more content, podcasts, interviews in the future.
Yes, thanks for this exciting discussion. Okay. Thanks to you.